Look, there's an interesting ad by Suncorp, so, you know, the big insurance company. They asked the question, if your home could talk, what would it say? And it essentially explores what a home reveals about those living in it. It's a really interesting ad. It's hard to deny that a home or a house captures some of the most intimate moments of our lives. Because our homes are the places where we can be ourselves, right? And if it captures those moments, wouldn't we want to take care of our home? Now at its core, it's just trying to sell us house insurance. But I find the ad interesting in how it lures us in emotively. You see, it captures something I think that is so fundamental about our existence as human beings. We are physical and spiritual creatures that seek and crave to belong. And a physical place, a home if you like, frames and contextualizes that belong for us. So contextualize is a funny word to say. A home provides the context for you to belong. But I guess I'm not so much interested, if you like, as Suncorp was, about what would your home, if your home could talk, what would it say, as I am about the question of where is your true home? Is it that multi-hundred-thousand-dollar sort of mortgage you pay every week? Or rent? Is it the country you were born in or the country you live in? Is it where your family or loved ones are? Where is your true home? Well, Paul has something to say on this topic. And though back then they may not have had the worry of rising interest rates or rising costs of living, they still had, as a culture, as a people, the same longing and pressures we do today around belonging. And what does it mean to belong and to have a home? So read with me chapter 5, verse 1. I have the words behind me as well. For we know that if our earthly tent we live in is destroyed, we have a building from God, an eternal dwelling in the heavens, not made with hands. Indeed, we groan in this tent, desiring to put on our heavenly dwelling, since when we are clothed, we will not be found naked. Indeed, we groan while we're in this tent, burdened as we are, because we do not want to be unclothed, but clothed, so that mortality may be swallowed up by life. Now, the one who prepared us for this very purpose is God, who gave us the Spirit as a down payment. Now, look, Paul would have made a very poor home insurance seller. I think his insurance slogan would have gone something like this: don't buy it, just trust in Jesus, because one day you'll get an even better home. Like, imagine that was your slogan for his insurance company, right? You see, he basically implies that our earthly dwellings, our homes, our houses, don't matter, since we have an eternal, everlasting, and forever home made by God himself. He's really saying that, in comparison, if you like, our homes here are like tents. I don't know if you've ever camped in a tent, but it's not the place you would think would want to live most of your life. But at this point, you'd be struck by the fact that Paul has failed his English grammar class, because one thing we're encouraged never to do is mix metaphors. And that's exactly what Paul does here. But I think the fact that he does makes his point even more richer and beautiful for it. You see, notice how Paul uses the term earthly tent or earthly home. You'd be excused if you thought he meant that physical house that you may live in or dwell in, but not exactly. He's playing on something here that is worth us wrestling with. And the clue is given in the next two verses. That's verse 1. And so in verse 2 and 3, he says, indeed we groan in this tent, so earthly sort of home tent, desiring to put on our heavenly dwelling, since when we are clothed, we will not be found naked. Our home is what we wear. As I said, mixing metaphors isn't always helpful until it is. Because I think Paul does something brilliant here, which is incredibly relevant in a time and age where the question around identity and belonging is as complex and as confused as it ever has ever been, right? Alongside the incredible pressure in our Australian context to own a home, to find somewhere to rent, I think what he says here is so important. But first, you have to quickly capture who's saying this. If you don't know, Paul was a Jew, which was an identity marker that he or any other Jew at the time was incredibly proud of. They were known as the chosen people of God. I'd argue that Paul once staked everything on this identity marker. He was a Pharisee, so he was a religious elite. He took being a Jew to the next level. And as a Jew, he had the importance of, he understood the importance of a physical home, especially in the light of God, what God had promised their ancient ancestor Abraham. It's no coincidence when God chose Abram, he made three profound promises: that he would have a large family, that he would be a blessing to all nations, that he would bring joy, happiness to all nations through his family, and that he would inherit a land, a home. And right through the Old Testament, so the Old Testament is the history before Jesus comes into the picture, this idea is emphasized time and time again. Yet, notice what Paul does here when he combines the idea of a physical home of earth and water with our physical body of who we are. Paul no longer sees that patch of dust in the Middle East as his true home. And he no longer sees his whole identity wrapped up in being a Jew. You have to capture how big of a deal that is for a former Pharisee. Paul finds his true home, his true identity somewhere else. So let me use this illustration. I want you to think about, just be a bit introspective, when do you feel most at home? And think about why. So like, you know, whatever, that you don't have to call out anything, but when do you feel most at home and why? For me, it's our home in Ripley with Catherine and the kids. I feel most at home with them. And because I feel most at home with them, you can ask Catherine this. When it is just them, I wear what I think is the most comfortable clothes ever invented by human beings. Shorts and a singlet. I get in trouble all the time during winter because I complain how cold it is while wearing shorts and singlets. For Catherine, it's, well, put pants on and a jumper on. But straight up, my true clothes as your pastor is relaxed bogan. That if I could most of my life go that way, it would be a glorious thing. But stay with me for a minute. If you removed Catherine and the kids from my Ripley home, I could wear all the shorts and singlets in the world, but that place would cease to be home. Without them, it's not home. Or if you place me in a situation like church today or our service today, where Catherine and the kids are present, but that physical location isn't. Notice I'm not wearing shorts and singlets. The hall doesn't ever really feel like home either. In a similar way, Paul is trying to show the Corinthians, who lived in a pretty important and prominent city, who faced the pressures of being what the culture and the world around them told them to be. In that context, Paul is telling them that their true self and their true home isn't here. No, their true and real home is where God is. It's why Paul says, we have a building from God, an eternal dwelling in the heavens, not made with hands. That is home. That is the place, if you like, where we can be truly who we are. A place of true belonging, a place that can't be lost, taken, or destroyed. And it's found not in this earthly terrain, no matter how much traveling you do. But Paul says it's found with God. And because of this, we need to be aware that there will always be this tension for us, as Paul puts it. Indeed, we groan in this tent, desiring to put on our heavenly dwelling. Where we are and what we wear becomes that mixed metaphor of you can belong somewhere and you can truly be yourself. And so since this isn't home, since we're not with God as we should be, Since we're not fully clothed in Christ or those heavenly shorts and singlets, we groan. We have despair, discomfort, and pain. Because the reality of this tension means we're never settled here. I'd argue it's why when we buy a home, if you've ever bought one, that contentment only lasts a second before you imagine a bigger and better home somewhere else, and then you buy it. But then you'll move into that bigger and better home and be discontent with that. It's why when we look at the mirror, we don't see the beauty and worth God has clothed us with, but only the imperfections and the misstandards our world puts on us. It's why we swipe left and right for a relationship to satisfy us. It's why we feel like our physical body isn't who we are. Feel the dysphoria, feel the confusion. It's why we feel the weight of loss and hurt, feel the bruises and cuts, feel the anxiety and stress. It's why we feel scared and alone, and we can be in a room full of people. There is a tension that is real because we do not want to be unclothed, but clothed. So that mortality may be swallowed up by life. We go around life feeling naked and awkward because this will never be our home. Yet I love how Paul describes it here. That our heavenly clothing, which I admit isn't shorts and singlets, is life itself. We will one day clothe ourselves with life, with Christ, because God created us to fully feel at home with Him. It's why it says He purposed us for that very reality, that this isn't all there is. That is why our true home will be the place where we truly feel at home with Him and everything else. Though it's like a taster, though it's like a shadow, it could have moments where we go, oh, that feels lovely. You see, God has been preparing us for our true home ever since the beginning. It's the story of the gospel. It's the story of the Bible. And to make sure for us that this is legit, that this place does exist, Paul says we're given the down payment or the deposit of His Spirit as proof. In 2021, Catherine and I, with the help of our family, like me and Catherine couldn't have done this if our families didn't sort of help us, we were able to buy our first home in Australia. I wish I could say the experience was blissful, but it wasn't. It was probably one of the most stressful experiences I have ever had to go through, because there was so much that you had to know that I didn't know, and it required you to care about the little details, which I don't. But I remember the day we finally put the down payment for the house, the most money I've ever seen in my life, and settlement was reached. The process itself guaranteed that we had a home. Though we still lived here in Providence, we were guaranteed there was a home. We were given, you know, the call from the lawyers saying, you've got a home. I remember they rang us and I was like, oh, great. I was just so overwhelmed with it all. But we had a home. The down payment was settled. In a much more powerful way, though, God put the down payment for our home in the most extraordinary way. Jesus Himself paid the price for that down payment, His Spirit. Read with him. So we are always confident, verse 6, and know that while we are at home in the body, we are away from the Lord. For we walk by faith, not by sight. In fact, we are confident and we would prefer to be away from the body and at home with the Lord. Therefore, we are at home, or whether we are at home or away, we make it our aim to be pleasing to Him. 2022 for our family has been the year where I've been most away from them. I've been this year alone, like a 3 training intensive, a few conferences, camps and other things. And it's hard to be away from family, just is. I found it, though, the hardest when Catherine went away. I'll be honest, when Catherine isn't home, we hold it all together with blue tack and tape. That's how me and the kids survive. But let me share a nervous joke I have in my mind when Catherine is away. What if she likes this newfound freedom and doesn't come back? What if she realizes she married way below her belt? Do you know what snaps me back every time? The relationship I have with her. Now, I know in our current sort of culture and context, this should sound ridiculous, but my confidence is in our marriage. Not just because we made promises to each other, but the type of relationship I have with her and the evidence of that relationship that we have with one another is what reassures me of that reality. So when she's not home, I walk by faith and not by sight. That isn't to imply that faith is blind, but rather that faith is a trust in what you don't always see. I don't see her, but I trust her and walk within that trust that she will return. But you see, that when the Bible talks about faith, the way it's translated in the Greek pistuo is actually means trust, a proven trust. It's not like our culture says, oh, you have faith, as in you have belief, like we believe in, you know, fairy tales, and that's the equivalent of believing in Jesus. That's not how it works. It's a trust. But that trust I have in Catherine pales in comparison. To the reliability and trustworthiness of Jesus. Not only do we have that down payment of his spirit or the historical evidence and accounts of his life that he's real, that he existed, but more than that, we have the events recorded before of God's promises that he would do all of this. That God time and time again proved that he alone is trustworthy and he alone keeps his promises. Beloved and friends, we all live life with the theme of faith in our lives. If by faith we mean a proven trust and not a blind belief. You see, you hopped in your cars today, trusting, having faith in, that they would work for you. You trusted in the road rules and that others would do the same. You sat on the seats that you're sitting in, trusting that they would hold you. You go to work and have faith that your employer will pay you for the work that you do. You love the people you love on the premise of trust, of faith. We all walk by faith to a degree. The better question is then, does what you trust hold up? Can it deliver? Can it keep its promise? If we can trust a chair or a car or an employer, how much more should we trust in the maker of heaven and earth who has never failed in any of his promises? You see, there is something better ahead for us. We know heaven will make this momentary light affliction that we call life seem incomparable to the glory to come. And if that is the case, then how we live in the light of that matters. Because trust is active. You can't say, I trust someone and then not trust them. You can't say, I trust this chair and then not sit on it. That's not how trust works. And as we learn in the letter of James, faith without works is dead. In other words, if we trust in Jesus, that our true home and identity isn't here but with him, how we live matters. You see, the week Catherine was away, she's not here, so I can admit this, I was determined to not put unnecessary pillows on our bed. I was determined not to make the bed at all, because who has the time, right? And yet, because I loved her, I would get up in the morning and make my bed and put pillows there. I aimed to please her and she wasn't even there. I found myself at night with all the dirty plates cleaning them. I don't do that. Like, that's a Catherine thing. Catherine's the cleaner, and yet my affections for her meant I was aiming to please her even when she was not there. You see, what we have in the Christian faith isn't blind belief or even a trust in a religious institution. If this is what this is, just a religious institution, go to the beach, do something else. But rather, what we have in the Christian faith is a relationship with the living God. So, beloved, how much more should we live our lives to please Christ, who has given us everything that we, that how we live and breathe and move? Everything comes from Him. If we truly entrust ourselves to Him, then that means we play out that relationship in everyday life. Like, this isn't just the Sunday deal. Okay, look, I'll just be the Christian on the Sunday, but every time else it's me time. It's not rocket science. But then that means, do we know what pleases Jesus? If you're in a relationship with someone, you need to work really hard. So when I first got married, I thought cuddles and a kiss would just delight Catherine. She's not. She's a person that loves you doing things for her. I had to work really hard at trying to understand my wife's heart in order to please her. How much more should we work hard at understanding the heart of the one who truly loves us? Do you know what pleases Jesus? Let me give you two quick sound bites that I think give us an important insight into what pleases Him, what brings Him true delight and joy, because it's the reason He came in the first place. Really, really quickly. He says this about Himself: "For the Son of Man has come to seek and save the lost." He came for people who did not know the hope of life that can be found in God. That's what pleases Him. And then when He died and rose again, this is what He gave to His disciples: "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. I am the most important person on the planet and in all the universe." And what does He say? "Go therefore to His disciples, to His church, and make disciples of all nations." Two little sound bites of what it is to please Jesus. This is how we walk by faith and not by sight. How we please Him with by having the same heart He had, the same motivation He had for people and for this world. It was the first song we sang, right? "For God so loved the world, He gave us His one and only Son." Why? To seek and save the lost and to make them part of His family. That isn't a guilt trip, by the way. That is just what Jesus is about. And if you want to be about Jesus, you want to be in a relationship with Him, hey, these are just two pretty standard sound bites of what pleases Him. And I would argue we make a mockery of what He came to do if we make little of what pleases Him. Because, beloved and friends, what He came to do and what He entrusted us as His family to do is both a privilege and a confronting reality. Read with me what Paul says. "For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each may be repaid for what he has done in the body, whether good or evil. Therefore, since we know the fear of the Lord, we try to persuade people. What we are is plain to God, and I hope it is also plain to your consciences. We are not commending ourselves to you again by giving you an opportunity to be proud of us, so then you may have a reply for those who take pride in outward appearance rather than the heart. For if we are out of our mind, it is for God. If we are in our right mind, it is for you." End of last year, we went to holiday up in the sunny coast. And there was this interesting moment one day when we were just at the beach enjoying the beauty and wonder of it, right? I observed a class of learning surfers. Like, I wasn't going to go, I was just watching them. And they spent a lot of time, like, on the sand, you know, trying to, like, stand up, and it was really fascinating. But what I found really, really interesting is when the group of fledgling surfers were able to go into the beach, into the water, and there was a couple of instructors that stayed behind as other instructors went into the water with them. And there was this commentary that the guys had that just, like, caught my attention. And especially when one naive sort of learner tried to, like jump a particularly big wave with their board, like they were trying to get over it. And both of them had this like small knowing chuckle. And one of them said, "What did he expect would happen?" Now, I was struck by a range of emotions at that moment. At one level, I was smugly agreeing with them as though I had some idea how to surf and read the waves, which I don't. But if I'm honest, I would have probably done the same thing that the learner surfer did. But what struck me, on the other hand, was what that statement meant. Those instructors knew how to surf. They knew how to read the waves. They understood the ocean in a way that most of us on the beach didn't. They understood the law of the ocean, that what you can and cannot do in the light of its strength, its power and authority, that no matter how talented or gifted you are, there are things you can't avoid. What did you expect would happen? Is what he said. You see, one day, all of us, regardless of race, regardless of gender or status, regardless of where you live, what you own, or how much you've achieved, one day, all of us will appear before King Jesus. And each one of us will give an account with what we did with our lives, what we did with our bodies, good or evil. That isn't a matter of popular opinion. This is just how the fabric of the universe works. It's like the laws of gravity. It's like the laws of the ocean. To live in a moral world where justice matters means that there is a moral giver who will one day ultimately uphold that justice. It's not a matter of being vindictive or cruel or mean. No, the laws of our existence means we will one day give an account. And because of this, notice what Paul says. Therefore, since we know the fear of the Lord, we try to persuade people. What are we trying to persuade people of? That Jesus came so that we wouldn't face that judgment alone, or rather that we wouldn't face it on our own. Paul's life was the evidence of that reality, if you know his history. He was a persecutor. He was a murderer of the Christian faith. He understands how powerful this message is because one day he would have stood before that judgment throne and he would have had to give an account of what he did against Christ and his family. And yet Christ confronts him with the message of hope and his life is completely transformed. Yet notice the phrase he uses, Rise. Notice his motivation. Since we know the fear of the Lord is what leads him to persuade people. Now, the fear of the Lord is such a crucial theme in the Bible and one that isn't often talked about or celebrated. It's kind of that awkward sort of thing that Christians try to avoid. Mainly, I think, because we associate fear in the negative. But if I was to summarize for you, because there's so much that can be said about the fear of the Lord, what the fear of the Lord is to understand who God truly is. The fear of the Lord, and I've done this before, is like the ocean. You see, the ocean by its very nature is powerful. It is terrifying. It is uncontrollable. It demands respect and reverence just by its very nature. That is the fear of the Lord on one hand. It is terrifying. But if rightly understood, if you rightly understand who God is, that very ocean becomes a vast ocean of delight. That ocean is the breadth and depth of unmeasurable love. It's rolling constant waves of mercy and grace. It's the expanse of limitless relationship and enjoyment. If you fear the Lord, rightly understand who God is, it doesn't leave you terrified and fearful. It actually leads you into relationship, to trust and dependence. That's why the fear of the Lord is only the beginning of wisdom and not its end. Trust and dependence is. Relationship with God is. You see, Paul knew this. Paul understood what pleased the Lord, that he came to seek and save the lost, that he sends out his people, his church, to make disciples, to make people understand who Jesus is and bring them into that relationship. He understood that his true home wasn't here with the Lord. He understood what was at stake if people didn't turn to the Lord. That unavoidable reality, like the overpowering ocean. And he knew the only solution, the only hope, the only answer was Jesus Christ himself. He understood who God is. And so he tried with everything he had to persuade people of this. Which is why he remarks, just really quickly, what we are is plain to God. He knows we're sinners, messy, broken, that our lives aren't perfect. And he says, and I hope it is also plain to your consciences. Paul knows we're lost without Jesus. He knows how messy we are, that we're jars of clay, weak and frail. So Paul says, I have nothing to hide. I'm a nobody. But what I do, though the world think me crazy or out of my mind, I do for God. And I do it so that you, the church, us, would gain the immeasurable treasure, this gift of life, this hope and life that is only found in Jesus. What compels him wasn't just fear, but love. Because you see, the fear of the Lord, rightly understood, always leads us to love. Understanding who God truly is will always lead you to the cross of Christ, the death of Jesus, the life we wear, and the love that motivates us. Look with me the last few verses. For the love of Christ compels us, since we have reached this conclusion, that one died for all, and therefore all died. And he, Jesus, died for all, so that those who live should no longer live for themselves, but the one who died for them and was raised. I think the notion that Jesus died for all can become as confusing as chicken feet soup, or as familiar a thing as, like, how's the weather? It can create in us an intriguing disgust, like, oh, that's a bit full on, why did he have to do that? Or just an indifferent, yeah, Jesus died for me. I fear that the notion that Jesus would die for us has become either so foreign, so familiar, that we've missed the significance and beauty of it. And yet we, who claim to love and follow Jesus, stake everything on this reality. Like, well, the reason we are here is because Jesus died on the cross. Now, yes, it can be this intriguing disgust of like, oh, you guys are just too full on. It can be like, yeah, get on with it so I can get on with my life. Or for a moment, can we remember or capture what that means? I've recently been trying to get healthier, and in the process of getting healthier, as you know, you do lots of different things. I did this online survey around my health. And one question really struck me amongst a whole range of questions. And it said, do you ever feel ashamed of your body in front of people, especially friends and family? I had a range of answers you can choose from. I didn't hesitate to just tick yes and move on. But the thought came to me, if that's what it's like for me, who in one sense isn't, I'm not that overly concerned with my body image. What is it like for those who are concerned? I've noticed lately that my eyes are getting worse at night. My memory isn't as sharp as it used to be. I'm almost 40, so my bones and muscles just ache when I do the simplest things. I've begun to notice the gleam fade in my children's eyes when they used to turn and go, Daddy! Now I go, oh, it's Dad. Not to mention the constant pressure I feel to please people and have them like me. The pressure to own this or have that because everyone else has this and has that. The FOMO I feel over a range of things the world holds out. And then don't get me started on the mess of my heart. The mess of my mind, my sin, my shame, my guilt, my insecurity, my frustrations, my fears, my weaknesses, the parts I don't want any of you to see or notice about me. And yet, someone saw all of me, every single detail, all of it exposed, brought to the light, my past, my present and my future. And their response was, that's what I want. That is who I love. And that is who I will die for. Their priceless life for mine. You see, it isn't that Jesus died on some random cross over 2,000 years ago for the sake of it so that we can build a religion. Also that people would owe him one. No, he died to save us from ourselves, to restore our broken relationship with God, to fix our mess, to pay the penalty of what it would cost to stand before him and to give an account for our lives. He did it for you and I. So that we'd be forgiven, we'd be free, we'd be loved, we would be his. I anchor my identity, not the notion of what I think of myself or what others think around me. That is so dangerous, church, and it is killing us. I don't stake my identity in what I've achieved or own or do, because one day my body and my mind will fail. My stuff rust and fade. One day people will forget. I don't place my hope in a patch of dirt found in Ripley. I anchor it all in Christ. Beloved, that is all I have as your pastor and as your friend. I'm serious. I'm not that impressive or remarkable. You ask my children and them. I choose to live for Christ and tell others about him because it's his love that compels me with something better than what is on offer in this world. That someone saw all of me and said, he is worth dying for. Someone saw my sin-stained clothes and decided to wash me as white as snow, spotless and pure, and clothe me with imperishable, immortal, everlasting clothes. Someone saw that I was lost, that I was dead, that I was nothing, had nothing, and still said, I have prepared a place for you with me, that you are precious and mine forevermore, beloved and glorious. And that isn't even scratching the surface of what it means that Christ died for all and therefore all died. But I think that exchange demands a response one way or another. And I guess the question for us is, what will it be? Will it be that all too familiar, yeah, Jesus died for me, can I just get back to my life? Or maybe that intriguing disgust of, oh yeah, that sounds pretty full on and a bit too weird for me. So thanks, now I just want to get on with my life. Or could it be for us in this moment that persuasion that Christ came for you and I, saw all of us, there's nothing you can hide. To top it off, one day we'll stand before him anyway. Could it be the moment where you accept what he has to offer? That you're persuaded that he gave up his life in love for you, all of you. That he gave up his life, not just for all of you, but for all of the Ripley Valley and beyond, for all of those in Central Asia. I love that Luke and Sam are wrestling with, these guys do not deserve the gospel, but they so do. Can it be maybe this moment that it's a refreshing in our commitment to him, that we should live our lives to please him, because that is the most freeing, most beautiful thing to do. Let's pray.